We had lots of wires up, lots of FISA warrants. We were being as much of a pain in the neck to every one of the crime families to try to get them to give them up to us.
What does he decide to do on that Sunday morning? Of his own volition, without telling anyone else, he knocks on the door of John Gotti.
He's got not only the FBI after him, but he's got the mob after him. That couldn't have been comfortable.
Hey, this is Justin and Aaron from the Generation Y podcast, where we explore hundreds of unsolved murders and conspiracy theories. This week's episode, we dive into the murder of Jason Kopack. Jason and his friend Brian Simmons played D&D and listened to heavy metal music. Brian Simmons bragged about being a Satanist and would end up bragging to his friends about the murder of Jason Kopack. Listen to the Generation Y podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the Wondery app. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free.
Hello and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor. Jim, I'm very excited. We were in the middle of a cliffhanger and in the middle of a really interesting case that involves the New York mob, Sammy the Bull Gravano, with one of our very favorite guests. And he is?
James R. Fitzgerald. Great to be back, guys.
Thank you so much for coming back, Fitz. I just know that all our listeners have been texting and emailing this week, aggravated that we've once again taken one of your cases and split it in half so that they had to wait a week to get this one. So let's just jump right back in. Jim was just talking about something that you guys had experienced early on in the case. Jim, remind us what that was.
Yeah, this is when we were on a surveillance of Gus Faraci's grandmother's house, which was in this sort of secluded neighborhood on Staten Island. We were sitting there on that house overnight, waiting to see if anybody came or left to see if possibly Faraci went there to hide or came there for help. And as the sun was rising up, we could tell that in the second story window of the house that was parallel to where we were parked, we could see the silhouette of a man looking out at us. And it was very chilling because obviously we knew that this was a mobbed up neighborhood. And was this something where we were at risk? Did our cover get blown? Are we going to have to blow the scene, get out of there? But as the light came up fully, we actually could tell that it wasn't somebody looking at us, was it, Fitz?
Well, no, it wasn't. It was a two-dimensional, full-color piece of paper on the wall.
It was. It was actually a poster for the show Wise Guy. And it was a picture of Ken Wall, who played an undercover FBI agent. And what we realized was it was the neighbor of this grandmother that was sort of playing a prank on them, that they had the FBI agent, the undercover FBI agent, staring at their house 24/7, 365.
Seems like maybe a risky move.
I don't think so. But what's crazy is I have a connection to Ken Wall in that Tim and I, when we were in Fordham, we met Ken Wall because we were actually in the movie The Wanderers, which Ken Wall starred in. And in fact, in the show Wise Guy, Ken Wall's undercover FBI agent character actually went to Fordham. So he would often wear a Fordham sweatshirt as an undercover agent. So it was just kind of really cool that we had this connection. And one of the crazy things was after this happened on Staten Island, after everything was resolved, I had written to Ken. I actually sent him an FBI hat and an FBI raid jacket and told him of our connection to Fordham and reminisced about the movie The Wanderers. And I never heard back from him. I was so disappointed. But then when I left my apartment, when I moved out of my apartment years later, I found out that the envelope that was stamped and addressed had fallen behind my desk and I had never actually mailed it. So that resurrected Ken. But, you know, Ken Wall basically went underground. He, after that series, he stopped acting. He was in, I think he was in Crime Story for a while, but then kind of disappeared off the face of the earth. And that was that. But anyway, bringing us back, we then, after we resolved the issue of blowing our surveillance and Ken Wall staring at us from across the street, we actually went and knocked, we got the order to go and interview the grandmother. And I don't know if you remember, Fitz, but we knock on the door, we're allowed in, and the grandmother is sitting at the kitchen table, folding her laundry, smoking a cigarette, cool as a cucumber, doesn't even look at us. Like, you talked earlier, Francie, about how the mobsters were, how, you know, rude and dismissive they could be. She's sitting there smoking her cigarette, folding her laundry, being just as much of a wise ass as she possibly could to these two young FBI agents who were there trying to resolve the murder of one of our fellow agents. And she couldn't have been more casual and nonplussed about the fact that the FBI was interrogating her about her grandson, Gus Faraci, who at this point we had very strong evidence to believe was the murderer of Agent Everett Hatcher. Do you remember that, Fitz?
I wasn't in on that interview, but I remember you telling me about it afterwards, the whole Ken Wall poster and Grandmama, and it was bizarre, but that laid the foundation for what we would see down the line with wives, with daughters, you know, adult children of these guys, with the gumas, the girlfriends of these guys. It's a very complex, interwoven personal relationship these folks have, and the one thing is, with the exception of Dominic and one or two others, Dominic Faraci, the cousin, you don't talk. You'll be polite. They never slammed doors on our faces. They never said, get the F out of here, but they wouldn't tell you what you wanted to know.
Well, so Fitz, that's a great segue back into your story. Last time we were here talking, you were talking about having found the murder weapon. So now you've got all the probable cause you need to build that arrest case against him, to arrest him and even prosecute Gus Faraci for the murder of DEA agent Hatcher. So once you have the gun, what do you do?
Well, we're still following leads. We're still following phone records, a lot of information in phone record. Now, these weren't wiretaps, remember. These are just numbers, who's calling who, what day, what time. One of the numbers came back to the home of a Bonanno family capo, Jerry Chili. And it turns out his daughter, Babe, Margaret Babe Chili, was the widow of a mobster who was the victim of a hit. So she's living with mom and dad, and she somehow heard of Gus's problems, Faraci's problems being on the run. She hid him in their daddy's house for a few days. And Sammy the Bull later talks about this in his YouTube interview. But the bottom line is that really pissed off some mob members, because now they know how the FBI is looking for this guy, even within, you know, a week or so of the murder. So we get a search warrant for the house. We were pretty sure Gus was gone, but we still felt there may be evidence in there. And I'll never forget being on the scene that day of the split level home in a nice section of Staten Island. And we brought in the SWAT team and these guys in their full tactical gear with helmets, shoulder weapons, whatever. We get in the door, knock on the door, search warrant, looking for Gus, looking for evidence, did everything we had to do. Gus was not there. Jerry Chili, again, the Bonanno family capo, very polite, his wife. They did arrest the daughter for harboring a fugitive. But I'll never forget the little grandkids. Her kids were there, like 6 and 7 years old. And I'm actually in earshot. And they're saying, Grandpa, where's mommy going in handcuffs? And, she's going to talk to some men. She's fine. Oh. And then why are these soldiers here? Why are these military-like men here with their guns? And Jerry Chili, again, the grandfather, the capo, looks at the kids. Yeah, they're here looking for bugs. They're the termite men. Oh, okay. And ever since then, we joked among ourselves in the task force, let's get the termite men to go out. Maybe this is where Gus is hiding. So I'll never forget that search. The daughter was arrested. You know, she was in her late 20s at that point. But no other evidence really came about in that regard until we got a name of a guy named John Petricelli. He was in prison with Gus. He lived in White Plains, New York. And apparently when Babe dropped Gus off, she got arrested. Gus had to reach out for someone from his past. Apparently, Gus saved Petrocelli's life in prison in some kind of a brawl that took place in the cell block somewhere. So we get information. He's up there talking to him, and we look him up. He's a mob guy. He's with the Lucchese family. So it's interesting how these families...
Gus was trying to be in the Bonanno crime family, but...
Yes, he was associated with that family. And these are kind of like... They get along mostly, but they're competitors. But the word went out that Petrocelli was watching. We were finding this out or taking care of Gus. And we found out after the fact that Jerry Chili learned this, again, Babe's father, and who knew Gus too, and said, Petrocelli, you got to kill him. The heat's too much. We're getting our social club shut down. We can't do business. You got to kill him. Petrocelli didn't follow orders. And he said, basically, forget about it. And next thing you know, Rich Finelli and I, again, my partner on this, and my driving partner, really, but we were teamed up. We were all ready to interview him in White Plains. Maybe Gus would be there. We didn't know. And we took the proper precautions. But the day we're heading up to interview him, what do we find out? Petrocelli is murdered on the streets of White Plains, bullet through the head with a hood pulled up over his head.
That doesn't seem like a coincidence, Fitz.
No, there's no coincidences in this world. At first, I didn't know exactly what the hood meant. I know what a fish meant in the mouth or whatever, but a hood meant from old Sicilian tradition, it means you're keeping secrets from the family. And they knew he was harboring Gus, and they said, you know, you got to be taken out. So he was killed. So there's a lead that we almost had, you know, we did phone records, everything else, nothing gave us the info that we wanted, but here is one more fatality on the way to basically this competition of the FBI and the mob now both looking for Gus Faraci, because we wanted them to prosecute him and hopefully convict him. The mob wanted him not alive because he could talk, of course, about a lot of different things, but he was shutting down their businesses. And we were parole and probation violating these guys left and right. And we were just bad for business. So the mission was get Gus.
We had lots of wires up, lots of FISA warrants happening, right? We were being as much of a pain in the neck to every one of the crime families in and around New York City to try to get them to give them up to us.
Well, and so that must have made Gus feel pretty desperate at that point, Fitz. I mean, he's got not only the FBI after him, but he's got the mob after him, and maybe even two different families after him. That couldn't have been comfortable.
No, it wasn't. And I'll never forget one guy named Tony Lungarelli. He was a lieutenant in the Bonanno family, worked under Jerry Chili. We found him with some parole violations. And we said, all right, maybe this guy will talk. So we went over and knocked on his door in Brooklyn one morning. This is probably late summer, early fall. Tony, FBI. He answers the door at noon in his bathrobe, these old brown slippers, blue kind of stained pajamas underneath. Again, these guys are always polite. Certainly do the FBI. Yeah, come on in. He wants to turn off the kettle on the in the kitchen stove. We let him do that. I walk by his kitchen table. What does he have spread out? Not guns, not plans to the tunnel system of a map, not a prison break, something. He has the newspaper open to the food section, and he was literally cutting out coupons to go to the store that afternoon.
Mobsters are just like us.
Here's this tough mobster type of guy, but he has to save money at the supermarket too. Jim, you earlier mentioned wiretaps. We had a lot of those going at any given time. I mentioned earlier, or perhaps it was last week's episode, that Gus Faraci's wife was pregnant, and she was due to give birth that the summer of 89. And we were pretty sure Gus wouldn't be stupid enough to show up to Staten Island Hospital to, you know, visit his wife for the glorious occasion. But we thought maybe, just maybe, he'd make a phone call to her. And so we put a wiretap up on the phone. And here, every person who called Tony Faraci, T-O-N-I, Faraci, we were listening to. She eventually found out like a month later, because the DOJ, as you guys know, have to send a letter of some sort that you're, you know, there were overhears on your part. And she was so upset that at this blessed moment in her life, giving birth to her first child, that the FBI had the gall to be listening to her calls.
Imagine, we're listening to her calls and, oh, well, yeah, your friggin' baby daddy killed a DEA agent, executed him. Cold-blooded murder. Don't expect any kind of inconvenience in your life.
Well, bottom line, she wrote to the media, to her congressman, all that stuff. Nothing ever came of it. And Gus never did call. So we were convinced there nothing was going to happen. So still a bunch of leads being followed out. And I'll never forget coming into work one Monday morning. And John Coleman or Jerry Savnik, who was the case agent, someone said, "Did you hear what happened yesterday morning?" No, what?
Y'all, we all have those guilty pleasures, right? But you know, I don't feel any guilt about playing Best Fiends, because Best Fiends gives me an endless source of fun I can access anytime right on my phone. It's a match three puzzle game like none other. There are literally thousands of levels. They add new content all the time. I admit, I'm obsessed with Best Fiends. My favorite thing about the game is that rush of adrenaline I get whenever I beat a level and make it to the next one. It helps me de-stress when work gets a little bit crazy, when there's an awful lot of long recording sessions. I'm sure you'll feel the same way. All my friends and family play Best Fiends together. We enjoy a little, let's just call it friendly competition. There are over 100 million downloads. This 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is simply a must play. There's always one more level. We all love a good puzzle, especially those of us who love true crime. And Best Fiends gives you over 5,000 good puzzles. There are more levels, events, and challenges added all the time. So download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
We could all use a little help when things start to feel overwhelming. And stress looks different for different people. Maybe you're bogged down by your to-do list, feeling a little detached, or just feel stuck. Talkspace has thousands of licensed therapists in over 40 specialties, including depression, anxiety, relationships, and many more. Whatever you need support with, you'll have someone on your side to help you set your goals and stay accountable to achieving them. Talkspace is a fraction of the cost of in-person therapy, and instead of waiting for your appointment, you can send unlimited messages to your therapist 24/7, so you can vent anytime you need to from the comfort and convenience of your own home. Whether you prefer text, video, or voice messaging, your therapist will engage with you 5 days a week. Match with a licensed therapist today by going to Talkspace.com or downloading the app. As a listener of this podcast, you'll save $100 off your first month with code WONDERY. That's code WONDERY for $100 off at Talkspace.com.
Well, here the special agent in charge of the New York office of the DEA, his name was Robert Stuttman. While he was fine with the task force, he would come in and visit. I knew the guy, shook hands with him, nice man. He was frustrated it was going nowhere. This is in October now of 89, give or take 6 months after the murder of Agent Hatcher. What does he decide to do on that Sunday morning? Of his own volition, without telling anyone else, he knocks on the door of John Gotti.
What?
And he says, "John, I got to talk to you." And again, we gave him no authority to do this. I mean, we weren't technically his boss or anything, but it was really, really very bizarre. We weren't sure if this would help the case, hurt the case. We just didn't know. And I actually found, and Stuttman wrote a book years later, and I'll just give a few of the lines from it. That conversation by Stuttman's own written word. He knocks on his door. John Gotti answers, also in his bathrobe, but this was about 10 o'clock in the morning. This was in Howard Beach, Queens. "John, do you know who I am?" He nodded, "Yes. How can I help you?" "Stuttman, our guy, Hatcher, got whacked. I've been bringing pressure. You know how much it cost you in business, John. Do what's right or the pressure isn't going to get easier." Gotti. He nodded and, keeping his hands in his bathrobe pockets, said, "There is little I can say, but of course, I'm sorry." "Stuttman, Faraci whacked our guy. If you hear where he is, let us know. We want him." Then, as Stuttman wrote, Gotti nodded, but this time said nothing and stepped backward and closed the door. When he was asked about it later, he said, "I broke no laws, only a few regulations."
So he asked for a mobster's help.
He did. And if you listen to Sammy the Bull in his interview, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes, he acknowledges getting a visit by FBI agents too. and ask making the same request of him. So it was really a tenuous time. It was we weren't sure if he was in Manhattan, if he was in New York State, if he was in the country. Maybe he went to Italy like Michael Corleone did in The Godfather after he shot and killed the corrupt police officer in the movie. Anyway, so it was a frustrating time, and we weren't sure how much longer we'd be on this task force and what our next mission would be until one night in November of 89. I also get a phone call late at night, and here it was actually November 17th. Gus got whacked in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn at 18th Avenue and 81st Street. I'll never forget that. The numbers are, of course, just interposed. Is that ironic or coincidence? Who knows? But here he's with a guy named Joey Boy. And Sammy the Bull talks about Joey Boy. It was actually Joey Sclafani. And Joey Sclafani, at the end of Gus's life, I mean, they didn't know this, but he was helping him out, driving him around. But Joey Boy was the son of a maid guy in one of the families. And Gotti, in the meantime, brought on two other mobsters to set up this arranged hit. And Joey and Gus didn't know they were coming to basically for Gus to be killed. But they did. The two hitmen shot Gus, but then Joey jumps out of the car. He starts firing back at them. That wasn't supposed to happen. So they start shooting back at him. Gus is down. He's dead on the scene. Joey Sclafani is hurt, but he does manage to survive. So there's a whole big internecine war going on among the mobsters. You know, do we now kill Joey Sclafani, the son of this capo and this other family? So they had to come to an agreement that no, he'd be treated some other way. He didn't know it was a hit, yada, yada. But basically, that was the end of the life of Gus Faraci, basically 6-7 months from beginning to end. And he wound up in a pile of garbage on a cold night in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn.
Right. But the thing is that they killed him in exactly the same manner that he had killed Everett Hatcher. And I think that was a message. And I think it was a very intense message that was meant to keep their own people in line and to also say to the FBI, yeah, we didn't mean it to happen in the first place, so this is what we did for you. Of course, that's not what we wanted them to do.
Not at all. And you're right, there was a code on the streets. This wasn't the first time this happened. Usually it was in a lower level type of situation, but they realized Gus Faraci, and if you listen to Sammy the Bull talk, they realized he was a junkie, he was a steroid. He hit on Sammy the Bull's wife. Gus hit on Sammy the Bull's wife, you know, back in the day before all this stuff happened. And someone even told him, hey, you know that Sammy the Bull Gravano's wife you're hitting on? I don't give a F, man. I don't give an F. And Sammy's now saying, if you knew that, if he ever crossed paths with him back then, he would have kicked the crap out of him, or maybe worse, killed him in his own home, he said. I'm not sure how that would have played out, but we know Sammy killed enough people over the years. He cut a deal, and now he's out doing his own podcast.
So, Fitz, I mean, this seems to me to be complete chaos. It can't be something the FBI wants when you're looking for someone to bring them to justice. It's not justice when their own organization takes him out, not just to shut him up, but to send a message to their own people to keep them in line. I mean, that has to make things so much more complicated for law enforcement when you're in the middle of this kind of investigation.
Well, you're right. And it actually took about 8 years later to identify the two shooters of Gus Faraci, James Galliano and Mario Gallo. And they did a couple years in prison. They cooperated with some other stuff and they were out. So we did still search for those guys. It may have been the NYPD. I'm not sure, because that murder would not have been necessarily a federal offense. But I know the FBI had helped out. But it took us a few years to piece that whole part of the puzzle together. So it was a little bit of mayhem there, and the task force lasted about another month. And we all wondered, by the way, the whole time, everyone on the task force, everybody, quite frankly, everybody in the law enforcement in the U.S., any of us could come across Gus Faraci at any time. And the mugshots we had, or the pictures of him in the wife beater t-shirt, flexing his muscles, and, you know, but we had no idea what he would look like. Finally, we got some pictures of him from the morgue. He had gotten fat, so no more working out or steroids. He had dyed his hair red. He made it much longer than it was kind of even stylish in the late 80s. And he had a big full beard, looking like, you know, some kind of a mountain man or something. But he was always packing. He was always carrying a gun. But nonetheless, just like Everett Hatcher that night in Staten Island, he didn't have the time to pull it out. And before he even got out of the car, the passenger side, the hit team gave him a few shots right to the head, and he never saw to live another day.
Well, Everett Hatcher's murderer obviously paid for Everett Hatcher's death with his own life, which I suppose in some sense is justice. But Fitz, you know, you mentioned earlier Sammy the Bull and statements that Sammy the Bull Gravano has been making. You know, what's that all about?
Yeah, and I know, Jim, I'm sure you too, Francie, in all your prosecutions, it's one thing interviewing somebody, maybe even after post-conviction. Jim, you and I went to prisons and talked to serial rapists, and you hear stories from them. But it's very rare you get back inside of a major investigation from someone else's perspective. And Sammy the Bull, in his recent podcast, I listened to it twice just to kind of pick up the tidbits. And he knew basically back then as much as we knew back then, too, putting pieces of it together. He did miss the John Petrocelli story, or at least he just skipped over that for whatever reason. But there, he mentioned Jerry Chili and Babe Chili and all those types of things. But he missed the John Petrocelli.
Probably like I said, he was involved in that murder and didn't want to admit it.
Gee, you think so, Jim?
Yeah, I do.
And is that very, very possible? And he knew all about the hood part. So if not directly involved, certainly indirectly. But just, you know, the family decided this guy, Gus, is just not worth it for us. And I say the family, I mean, John Gotti and the other crime families, we got to take him out. So the word came out from very early on, when it looked like Gus was not going to give himself up, that that they were going to get him. And the race was on, which one of us would get him first.
Right. And it was basically, Faraci was hiding from the FBI, obviously, and the DEA and all the other federal agencies, but he was also hiding from the mafia. And, you know, obviously the mafia and the criminal underground permeates every borough in New York. And so he didn't have a lot of help at his disposal. But we did find out later that he grew a beard and got kind of fat, and he would hang out at a bar on the east side of Manhattan. I mean, reckless behavior for somebody who is on the lam both from the criminals and law enforcement.
Well, and speaking of behavior that I don't like, in addition to that, I don't know how you guys feel about this, especially you, Fitz, since you've listened to it, but I am unequivocally opposed to Sammy the Bull Gravano making any profit or money off of his career as a mob hitman. It offends me as a prosecutor and victim advocate that he continues to make money and has a platform. Who's putting him on the air? He's a mob hitman, and he has a podcast. I mean, I don't like it, Fitz. How do you feel about it?
I don't either.
Yeah, and wasn't there a Son of Sam law that convicted felons, I suppose, you know, couldn't make money off the crimes they committed?
Yeah,
but I guess it's...
That was taken down by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Okay, well... So, you know, here's the... Maybe they need the Sammy the Bull, you know, law passed at some point, but... You know, I guess First Amendment, whatever. And I guess even in telling the story, I mean, he kind of puts a spin on it that, you know, well, Gus was a bad guy. He doesn't say anything bad about FBI or DEA in that regard. So, I mean, he's kind of admitting he was at least associated with the bad guys. And but I really liked how he ended his little talk about describing basically the moral to the whole story of this Gus Faraci and the DEA thing. Basically, the moral is that Gus did not belong in this family, meaning to us in the mafia. And that's why everyone got a tongue lashing afterwards. That's how he put it. So in other words, the younger mob guys are saying, you know, you're not going to be one of us if you're going to be hooked up on steroids and selling drugs and just shooting randomly at people. You don't even know who they are. So they had to even straighten out their own ranks, it seems, a little bit after this whole debacle with Gus Faraci, which cost him his life and, much worse, you know, the life of a hardworking military veteran and DEA agent.
Wow. Well, thank you, Fitz. I mean, this has been so enlightening to talk to you about this story of the murder of the DEA agent and how it connected to the mob. I really appreciate your coming and talking to us about it.
Yeah, and just one last thing. Anyone who wants to get more details about this, they can read Chapter 9 in my Journey to the Center of the Mind, Book 3. Kind of put all the, you know, tell the whole story there of about 30 pages. So, yeah, it was a fascinating time in my life. I learned a lot about the mob. And real quick, there was a movie made afterwards with Tony Danza starring as Gus Faraci. And I learned back then how movies and Hollywood can change true facts around with different people. But they made the AUSA, Charlie Rose, who was a good guy. We all liked him. He's now deceased. But they made him the hero, kicking down doors and getting in gun battles and car chases with him. So it was a Sunday night movie on NBC, but it didn't go over very well with a lot of us.
So Fitz, thank you so much for coming on again. And you know, and Francie, you know, and Josh, I'm sure you know too, we will definitely have you back on again, Fitz, to talk about some other adventures, some of them Jim's adventures with the Jims, and some of them not. Because there was a time in our careers where I went undercover for a few years and you went, kept going on that and on the bank robbery task force. And then we would meet up again, wouldn't we, at the behavioral analysis unit?
Yes, we would.
More tales from the gyms.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Fitz, for being here. Thank you, Francie, Josh, and thank you to our listeners. Till next time, signing off. Best case, worst case.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production produced by Francie Hakes, Josh Murphy, and Jim Clementi at Empire Studios LA. Engineered and edited by Matt Gergel. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba and hosted by Wondery.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness Delight can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's D, the number 2, L.org.